subordinating function. It's placing one clause subordinate to the other and setting up certain relationship there. There are some similarities. Sometimes in English we may translate it the same way, but the function of the two words is a bit different. You'll see the range of that in chapter 42. Okay, yes.
The English word for the subordinating.
What's that?
The English word for.
Well, it can be either. It depends. That's the point. When it's subordinating, it'll probably be hot. In other words, in the next chapter, when it's coordinating, it'd be like gar here. In other words, gar is a coordinating type conjunction, whereas hot and some of these others would be subordinating. And sometimes gar isn't even, it doesn't even have so much of a coordinating effect. It's kind of explanatory. Sometimes you may not even have, sometimes there's got to be an emotional kind of impact too, or it's actually coordinating, but it's maybe coordinating to a previous sentence where the sentence has already stopped and a period has been there, and then you start with, you know, gar in the next sentence, and it ties you back to that one, but it's not so much like in English where you would have the sentence structure still flowing. But it's got that kind of a function. Okay. In other words, you could leave it out and still make sense. You could leave gar out of the sentence entirely and still make sense out of it by putting comma or something like that in, whereas when you get certain structures with hot and subordinating structures, you can't do that. Okay. Now, deh here is another one, bottom of this page. But when deh connects clauses between which some contrast is implied, it should be rendered but, yet, or however. When there is no contrast, it should be rendered simply by and. Now, this is a pretty good, straightforward, he's fairly good as far as the analysis of this. Deh is one of those ones that's real hard to nail down. It's relying on the context quite a bit. And the basic thing is, if you're seeing contrast in the context, then you may translate it. But, although it's not as strong as Allah that we saw before, which has got a far stronger contrasted sense, this is kind of a contrast, but it's not a real big contrast. And it can also just be and. It can also be just connecting things. It may be transitional. Sometimes deh is purely transitional. In such cases, it may be rendered now, then, or simply ignored. Now, the Hebrew students are familiar with while consecutive, and this is a very common way. I mean, this is something like that as far as the feeling. When you're connecting a narrative, and oftentimes in a narrative series, there's a narrative sequence. In other words, when you're telling a story, the deh will be used to connect one idea to the next. And so you'll very often see it that way. And in cases like that, you may not always just translate it and. It'll get a little bit repetitious. You may just translate it, now this happened, or then this, and then this. You see, it's kind of taking this narrative series function. So it's very much like the Hebrew while consecutive in that respect. So that if it's contrastive, you know, you can get a but there, and that'll happen with Hebrew too. So if you remember in the Hebrew students, you can get a contrastive sense as well. Okay, and here's some examples. When deh is used alone all by itself, pantas u koimethe somatha pantas deh ale ge somatha, we shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Now here we do have a contrast here, or at least a slight contrast. It's not a gigantic one, but we shall not all sleep. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. It might be translated, we shall not all sleep and we shall all be changed, but it's the fact that we have a negation in the first one and then a positive assertion in the second one gives you a contrast. It may not be as strong as some other types of contrastive constructions, but it would be more appropriate to translate it but in this case. And here, in the next example, we said Abraham egenesa ton Isaac de egenesen ton Yaakov. Trying to get the Greek transliteration of these Hebrew words. And Abraham begat Isaac, and Isaac begat Jacob. Notice Isaac here in the next clause, the death follows. It's postpositive, it follows Isaac. And it's continuing kind of a sequence here. It's a very sequential narrative type of situation. This happened, and then this happened, and this happened, and so forth. So it's appropriate to see da there. And then Matthew 1:18, tu da Jesu Christu he genesis hutos ein. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was thus. Now we're starting off da with the very first of the clause, of course, coming in the second position here. And so now the birth of Jesus Christ was thus, and the birth of Jesus Christ was thus. It's forming a transition in the narrative. So this is one of those words that's really hard to put a clear-cut definition on. And is approximate, but it's not as strong an and, you might say, as kai, if you can think of it that way. So I think the way I think of da is it's like the word and. It means it's a connective, but it's not as strong as kai. And if it's used in the contrastive sense, it's not as strong as Allah, but it's still got that kind of a function. And it's kind of tying things together and making a flow to things. And you get the feeling of that, I think, even in the fact that the word de is so short, and it's enclitic, and it doesn't take its own accent. Really, they've got an accent mark on it, but it's so short that it when you're pronouncing it, you'll stick it right onto the end of the thing. Tu da, so forth. Tu da Jesu Christu. So it does bear its own accent, but it's short, and it's short things make for easy transition, and they kind of the fact that it's so short, and the fact that it's post-positive, I guess that's more accurate. The fact that it's post-positive and that it's short is conducive to this kind of a function, to make things run together and flow very smoothly. Okay, then second point here, de in combination with other conjunctions and adverbs. You can have de together with kai, de kai. And of course that's got the idea of either but also or but even if there's contrastive, or and also and even if it's got this positive sense rather than the contrastive sense. So it's pretty much translating it the way that see, kai in functions like this are going to be also and even. They're usually going to be, kai will be used in situations where you're not connecting two things of similar kind. And then de in front of that, it's got this kind of a transitional idea. So it's kind of just combining what you've seen before. John 3:23 here, ein de kai Ioannes baptizon, and John was also baptizing. So the and, that first and is from the de, and that is showing the narrative sequence. This is another event that happened. See, and John was, and then the kai there is got this sense where you're not connecting two things of similar kind. So it's going to be translated also, or even, some kids, depending on the context. Yes, Eric.
They put it on kai, and they
tend to both
things of the same kind. Right. Is that limited to just words, or is it
also included clauses? Yes, it can include phrases. It can include words, phrases, clauses, and whole independent clauses where you've got two complete independent sentence structures that are being joined to form a compound sentence. So it can go up in the, you know, on a pretty high scale. So that's why you sometimes have to see the whole sentence to know for sure what you've got here, to know for sure whether or not it's joining things of similar kind. Usually when it does that, though, the kai will stand between those two elements. So you'll be able to see that. If it's coming further on down within one element, you're usually going to get a translation of also, like this. That's what I suspect is happening here. Or it's referring back to something that may be understood but was never stated or something like that, and so you get something like also as a translation. Generally, though, I think you're going to sense this without too much trouble. I don't think you're going to have to really try to force your mind to say, now, what is the exact situation here? As you're reading it, you'll pick it up pretty well without even thinking about it, and you'll translate it, and you'll know whether to say and, also, or even. That's pretty easy to follow, just trying to put it over in English grammar. Assuming, of course, your English grammar is pretty good. Okay. Now, here's the next one, mende, is really an important structure, and is one that you see very frequently. And it's very hard to translate in a word structure type of situation. It's like one of those things that's better felt than telt, almost. You know, you feel what mende is doing after you've seen it enough and gotten some exposure to it, but it's hard to translate. You can translate it in a certain way, but it seems like it's almost too much. it's not quite that strong. Let's see what he says here about it. When de is used to indicate a contrast between two syntactic elements, the first element is frequently indicated by men, which, like de, never comes first in its clause. So now we're looking at this contrastive sense of de, and very often when it's used in the contrastive sense, the first element that's being contrasted with the second element will be preceded by the word men, and of course men is also a postpositive, so it won't come actually in the very first spot. And so we have a combination, men something and then de something. He says, may sometimes be rendered on the one hand, on the other hand. And of course, but that's oftentimes a little bit laborious of a translation. It's almost too much, you know, to actually say it that way. But if you can at least think of it that way, the men is pointing out one thing, and then the dad is pointing out the other thing in contrast to it. You're setting up a contrastive structure, and these men deaf phrases are reasonably common. So he says, but this is usually much too emphatic. It is usually best to leave men untranslated. It simply adds emphasis to the first member of a contrast. And such emphasis is usually indicated by only by stress in the spoken language. And I think that is a pretty fair statement as far as what's happening with men and death. It's really hard to translate it. If you go to on the one hand or on the other hand, it's almost too much. And there doesn't seem to be anything between that and zero that you can use that you know in English that really fits well. There's no real good English equivalent for it. Although intonation patterns is what is largely in English doing this. With our intonation, we can express the idea that you're looking at this and then you're contrasting it with that. And unfortunately, intonation patterns can't be put in words very well, or you know, marked. You can use some kind of punctuation for some basic intonation, but something like this is more subtle. And so it's something that you will have to try to use some ingenuity. If you're dealing with an exegetical point where this does make some difference, you usually are going to have to do some discussion of it and explain the situation to the person rather than just rely only on a translation. Rotherham and some of those translations have a little bit of an advantage in that they can use these emphasis marks. And this is one place where Rotherham would do something like that. On the one hand or on the other hand, kind of an idea structure. See, I baptize you with water, but he that cometh after me, you know, and so forth. And you could put maybe some marks around the I or something to show the more of an intonation on this than that. That can be done in Rotherham's translation. But it's pretty hard to do other than you inventing some marks or inventing certain types of intonation indicators. So I suppose the best thing we can do is leave it up to your experience now as you begin to see this over and over again to really gain a feeling for it. And if you can think of at least this on the one hand, on the other idea to start with, I think that'll help you see the structure. And even though it is a little bit too emphatic or maybe a little bit too intense to actually translate it that way, it will help you to see how this thing is working. Yes, Mark?
I was wondering, men ever stand alone?
All by itself? No, it doesn't really stand by itself. It's always in patterns of men and debt, although there may be some instances. I think if you look on the next page, men sometimes occurs without debt, introducing an implied contrast, which is actually indicated, but not by debt. What happens is that kind of start the same structure, but sometimes they'll leave the debt out. And you kind of rely on a pause there or some other word to indicate the other end of it. So it can be used, but it's almost as though it's the dad was there, but they'd left it out for some reason. You know, in other words, it's hard to say that men can have its own independent function aside from this kind of a thing. There is also men-un combination, and we'll get to that on the next page. But and then there's menun and menun ge that can start out sentences. But as far as men all by itself, it's either going to be with de or in a few instances there'll be some other indicator of the contrast than de, either by pauses or by a different word. So I think it's really hard to. That's why if you want to look up a translation for men, it'd be interesting to look it up in the lexicon, see if they give you anything for it. They almost would have to define it in terms of the structure. And talk about this kind of a sentence structure, because to give a lexical definition of this thing would really be tough. Okay, so looking at the examples here, egomen humas baptizon en hudati ho de opisomu erchomenos, I baptize you with water, but he who comes after me. So here's the contrast. And the I should be stressed in spoken English. In other words, I do this. On the one hand, I do this. On the other hand, he does that. You see, that's the kind of contrast that you're seeing. And when rather than saying on the one hand or the other hand, we can do it with intonation. I do this, but he does that. It's more intonation in English. Then certain important constructions involving men de may be considered together. You may see the article on both men and de. Ho men and ho de. The one and the other. And here you're substantivizing these function words. And so you get kind of an interesting combination there. Like I told you before, they can put an article on just about anything, and that's what happens here. Or hoi men and hoi de, using the plural forms, some and others. Now, of course, men and de aren't going to change their forms, but the article, whether it's singular or plural, is going to indicate that. Substantives need not occur with the articles and the expressions above. Sometimes it'll be just the one or the other, rather than the one this or the one that. It may be just all by itself. And the articles in these combinations may function as pronouns. That's kind of what's happening. The one, the other, the article is kind of functioning almost like a pronoun, and then the men and the de is setting up the contrast. And so you get kind of these combination functions. Some feel that there's connections. You'll see that there's lots of connections between the idea of an article and the idea of the relative pronoun. It's almost as they're very close. The forms are similar, and the functions are similar. In some cases, there may even be a debate. It's just nothing but an accent difference between the form of the article and the form of the pronoun. And, of course, in those instances, it usually doesn't make much difference. The translation's going to end up the same. Now, we also find some other examples here. Hoi men and an aloide. Others, on the other hand, see, or heteroide. Here's a series combination where you'll say hoi men, aloide, and heteroide. And you can see what's happening here. Some, others, and others. Of course, he just translates it others and others. But remember the difference between alos and heteros? What's really happening here is you start out with some, and then additional ones, and then different additional ones. In other words, if you want to continue this series, you're going to have to emphasize that these others in the second group that you mentioned are different than the ones in the first group, other than the original one. I don't know if I can really express this easily, but there is a reason for that. This doesn't mean, see, this is the kind of thing he would argue, well, allos and heteros mean the same thing. But I would say just the opposite. When men, aloide, and then heteroide. It's taking you down the series. It's trying to show kind of a distributional thing where this group, the first ones say this, then this group, and then different ones over here, different than the other ones I just mentioned, say this, and then you could keep going with heterois, you know, all the way, or you might even have some alloys along the way too, depending on what you're trying to emphasize. Mm-hmm.
More different ones.
Right, perhaps, yeah, that could be too. Kind of depends on how much distinction they're wanting to generate, and whether they're wanting to make it clear that this group is distinct from this group. Okay, good point. Now, and then you got host men, host de, the one, the other. Same kind of translation, only this time with the relative pronoun rather than with the article. It's coming out in a similar translation. Okay, don't know if I'll go through all these examples here. I think they're pretty straightforward. That Acts 17:32, maybe just look at that, the second example there. Hoi men ek luazon hoi de apon. Some mocked, but others said. See, the context is demanding this but idea, this separation idea. And but hoi men, you see, you've got the article on men and then hoi de, the ones and the others. Some and others. Okay, I think the rest of those examples will be pretty straightforward, if there's any questions on them. Then, men sometimes occurs without de, introducing an implied contrast, or contrast which is actually indicated but not by de. So, sometimes the de will be missing, and there's an implied contrast, the rest of it may be left out. So, this first example here, this last phrase, ego men paulos, she starts out, we wanted to come to you, I, Paul, did. So, he first makes a statement, we wanted to come to you, and then he says, ego men paulos, and there's men seemingly by itself, but it's really implying a contrast. And Paul is saying, in effect, I more than others. And so the thing that's left out is the more than others idea. But he's, you know, I on the one hand more than the others, you know, the dad would be covering another clause that's just left out, and because it's pretty well understood. Okay, and then totemen emenen enho en topo duo emeras, and then you have epeta starting another clause. Then he stayed in the place where he was for 2 days. Afterward, see, ordinarily, you see, you would see a death right after epeta. You'd see epeta death, see, and set up that construction. On the one hand, he stayed in this place for 2 days, and on the other hand, afterward, you see. That's the idea you would normally see, but it's just omitted here, apparently because it's understood well enough just from the fact that there's a pause there and so forth. Okay, then mez also frequently followed by un, and when so followed often occurs without de, see below. So un can sometimes take that position that de does in this contrast, but men is still kind of a slave to something else to follow, so it's really hard to see it as a word by itself. Now he's going to talk about that combination when he talks about un, so he kind of makes a transition here and skips to discussing un. So see here is un occurs either alone or together with other conjunctions or adverbs. Alone, it introduces a sentence expressing the consequence or inference from what has gone before, or it may indicate a transition to a new subject. It thus corresponds to English so, then, therefore, consequently, accordingly, now, or next. Quite a range of translations of this, but the idea is either one of two things. It'll either be that the thing you're about to say is an inference from or a logical result from the thing you just said. So that would correspond more to therefore. In other words, you're saying something so, therefore this. And so un will be used in that sense. Or it may be this transitional idea where, you've got more of a narrative type of flow, and then you might say consequently, or, you know, it follows that. And there is the same kind of function. It may not be a logical deduction, though. It may just be a sequence in time that's being seen there. So the difference mainly is more of one of the logic involved, whether there's a logical connection or whether there's just a sequential connection. Accordingly, is your now or next. It's just a little bit weaker idea, and it doesn't have this stronger logical connection. But the function of un is pretty easy to ascertain, and I don't think there's too much difficulty in really handling this one. Un is also one of these postpositives. It comes in the second position usually, not in the first position. Okay, so here an example from Matthew 1:17: Pasai un hai genei apo Abraham eos David genei decatessivus. So all the generations from Abraham until David are 14 generations. See, the so there is kind of consequently, or it's following, you see this, the begats, you see, he mentions here of Matthew 1. You've got a whole series of so-and-so begat so-and-so. And then in summation of that, so all the generations from Abraham. See, consequently, all the same, you could put consequently, or therefore, or then, or accordingly. It kind of depends on how the flow is going, and which word you select in English is going to depend on what sounds good in English. So that's the idea. Here's another short one. Tiun, why then? Why then? Why on the basis of what's gone before, you see? So could be translated why therefore, something of that nature too. All right, that one's not difficult. That's probably got as close to a lexical translation as any of these words do.
Mm-hmm. I know there's another word that I see translated wherefore a lot.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what it is?
I wish I could.
Okay. It'll probably be, there are, in the next chapter we're going to get a few more that sometimes hoti can be translated that way. There's also kathos, hosper, kathaper, a number of these that may be translated that way. These real clear subordinating conjunctions, and so I guess maybe after we get through that next chapter, we'll see if that one of those is probably one of those in the next chapter that you're referring to, because there you have a stronger connective idea, and the sentence structures are such that the thing that follows is really dependent on the thing that went before. So some of these, the distinction between coordinating and subordinating conjunctions is sometimes fuzzy, and that it makes for a little bit of fortunately, we have the Greek to look at and then translate into English, so we kind of, you know, see what's there, and then we know how to translate it. But the hard thing would be sometimes predicting in going from English to Greek which one they would use, what kind of structure they would set up. That'd be a little bit more ambiguous. Yes? Well, it's just because if you've got another accented word following it, you see, it's since da is only one syllable, it's going to be on the last syllable. Remember, the rule for a switch from acute to grave is that if the word that follows has an accent, then you're going to, on the final syllable, change an acute to a grave. So it's just because da is hardly ever going to end up a sentence. If it was the very last word in a sentence or something, it might keep it, but otherwise it's going to...
Galatians 4:23 at the top of page 248,
Galatians
grave and it precedes act, which is...
Oh, yes, so that's an enclitic. I don't know. I have to check and see. Either it's a misprint or they're... it is. Yeah, something funny is going on. I can't remember if that normally has the accent or not. That's the thing you have to check, and sometimes you never even pay attention to those things. Let's see. If ek is normally enclitic... then the thing may be just... Sometimes you can get two of these things in a row that are enclitics, and they're both kind of a slave to the thing that follows. That may be what's happening there. But...
it shows page
1. Without an accent. Yeah, okay, that's probably what's happened then. There may be an obscure accent rule that covers that. We didn't really go through all of those rules for accents. There's a lot of little exceptions here and there that really aren't normally worth looking into. Let's see if I can happen to find it here. There may be some peculiarities with that here. Okay, when a word, the ultimate followed by an enclitic, it retains its accent, and the enclitic receives no accent. Okay, it's in.
In the UBS, it's also great.
Okay, so that is accurate to the UBS. I think the rules that cover that are on page 327 there. And there's when a word having an acute accent on its penult, that wouldn't follow. We need one on the ultima. Okay, when several enclitics occur together, all but the last have an acute accent. The last receives no accent. Well, let's see, we still got a grave, though. So that wouldn't follow that rule. Curious now. Well, all it really says here is that when a word accented on the ultima is followed by an enclitic, it retains its accent, and the enclitic receives no accent. Well, that's what's happening, but the question is now, it's going to a grave. So I guess it's not really stated here, but The only thing I can presume is that when it's followed by an enclitic, since the enclitic doesn't have any accent and it doesn't have anything to kind of measure the previous situation by, it's still a word, so it is being followed by a word, but it's an enclitic itself. Now, let's see. If there's anything else we could do. I suppose I have to just sit down and analyze this and try to find it somewhere in the rules. Apparently it's not a mistake, though. So it's either just an exception to the rule, or or there's a minute rule to cover it someplace. You can see why we haven't taken a lot of time to emphasize the accents. It's more trouble than it's worth, usually. Unless it affects meaning. The only real reason to slow down and really take a close look is if it affects meaning. In some instances, that'll be the case, but... Okay, I'll just stick one more thing on that.
As a matter of fact, that same thing, Galatians 4:23, men is also...
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you've got the same preposition following both of them, and it's going to a grave in both cases. So all the rule, the normal rule said if a word other than an enclitic follows immediately, the acute is changed to a grave. Note, however, that the interrogative tis always retains the acute. So according to that rule, if a word other than an enclitic follows, immediately the acute is changed to a grave, which would suggest that if an enclitic follows, then what you're normally seeing is that it stays an acute, but apparently this is an exception to that. Well, I was reading the normal rule on page 319. Page 319, general rules of accent, just our standard rule for when we turn an acute into a grave. It's part number 4, part C there under section 391. 4C there. So the short ultimate may itself have an acute accent provided a marked punctuation or an enclitic immediately follows. If a word other than an enclitic follows immediately, the acute is changed to a grave.
Well, that's
because
X is classified on
the frequency. Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, that'll do it for us. That'll do it for us. Yeah. Yeah, that's the answer to it, because it's proclitic, because it's going, you know, what we have to do is there's a pause there. We've got to kind of draw a line and then take X with the things that follow. It's kind of leaning towards what follows, and the other one's leaning on the things behind. So that'll do it for us.
Not
JF,
but
XA. Right, right. Yeah, think of Eck as going with what follows. Okay. That solves it. Okay. I had the feeling for what was happening there, but sometimes you got to find the right rule that nails it down. Okay. Any other questions on that? Okay, we were at the top, page 249 here. We have some un being used with some other conjunctions and adverbs. Ara un means so then or so therefore. And when you see what the meaning of ara is, that's pretty logical. And so ara un adelphoi, ophelatai esmen. So therefore, brethren, we are debtors. And then men un indicates continuity. It may be rendered so. Hey men un ecclesia echen erenein. So the church had peace. Don't know what else to say about that except that it's pretty much a combination of the things we've seen already. And the idea of contrast, again, this would be more analogous to what we saw on the previous page where there was no stated other end for the contrast. Then menun, written as one word, a menun gam may occur at the beginning of a clause. They add emphasis. Again, this idea of men putting emphasis, maybe that's the best thing to think of it. Menun get su tis a. Who are you? With stress upon you. Who are you? Or who on earth are you? As he says down here. In other words, it's trying to put some more emotion and stress upon the statement. Okay, then ara may but need not stand at the beginning of a clause. It is not to be confused with the interrogative ara we saw earlier. In general, it is synonymous with un but does not occur as frequently. So again, the synonyms are something that it may not be directly synonymous with it, because otherwise, why have two words? But the basic translation is about the same. So ara ephthasen ephumas hebasileia tuta u. Then the kingdom of God has come upon you. is such and such. In other words, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. And tis ara hutos esten. Who is this then? Who is this then? Or who is this therefore? Then it can be strengthened with ge. This little particle ge will kind of give a little bit more strength to it. Ara ge eleutheroi esen hoi huioi. Therefore, the sons are free. Some of these are just emotional differences. You know, in English, we will oftentimes choose words according to how we feel at the time. Choose them according to the emotional expression that you want to get. And it may be hard to give a lexical difference between two words other than just one's got a little bit more feeling to it in a particular context than another. The other one might be more appropriate in another context. So that's kind of the kinds of shades of differences we're dealing with here. And then for ara'un, we saw that above. So that gets so then or so therefore. Giving a little bit more continuity to it, maybe a little bit more flow to it, but still giving the idea of therefore or then. Then udeh and medeh are negatives here. Now, udeh is used if the verb's in the indicative, and then medeh in verbs with other moods, especially subjunctive, as we'll see when we get to the subjunctive chapter. They can be used alone as conjunctions, udeh and medeh, meaning nor or and not or neither, depending on what fits the context the best. So, u koipia, udeh nathe, they toil not, neither do they spin. So here we're translating it neither. I suppose it could be translated they do not toil and they do not spin. The idea of and not could be seen there too. Or neither. Neither's more of the way the old King James would have said it. And then with participles, we've got medeh there, not walking in cunning nor falsifying the word of God, you see. May peripatun test, which is participle, and panurgia, which is cunning. Medeh dolun test ton logon tutau, not falsifying the word of God. So two participles here, and this time medeh is going to be used, it's a contrast there. Then alone, not as conjunctions, udeh and medeh mean not even. Not even. If they're not really conjoining anything, if they're just kind of an adverb that's stuck on, then udeh en to Israel, to sautein, piston, huron. Not even in Israel have I found such faith. So here it's not being conjoined to anything, so you get more of an adverbial sense. But still that negative idea, not even. And then udeh or medeh and medeh correspond to the English neither or nor. So you can put them together, neither nor. That's pretty straightforward. It's kind of like either or. It's like A and A we saw before. Okay. Udeh gar ego para anthropu paralabon auto udeh edidakthein. For I neither received it from man nor was I taught it. So udeh, the first udeh is indicating neither. The next one is nor. That's pretty straightforward. Okay. Questions? Eric. Something. It's usually trying to give a little bit more emphasis than you would normally find it. And do you see enough of the verse to see which instances those are, what the rest of the context is? Let's just use four times then, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
I know it's probably
can't say it. Yeah. It's just got, you know, just look for a little bit more emotion to it, a little bit more feeling to it. And that's kind of the basic idea there. Okay. Lesson 41 exercises. Let's take a look at those. Yes,
One question. I'm wondering if there's any real difference between Ute and Ude then, because there's a different conjunctions that are added on.
Yes, the ute and the ude, let's see, what page do we have the ute on? 246. Yeah, some of these are just, neither nor, same thing. It may just be a variant spelling of the same word. The function doesn't seem to be any different. And of course you're changing from ute to mete. So I wouldn't look for any difference. One might look it up and see how often each one is used.
It looks like the ute, they're adding a negative plus the conjunction te and the ute.
Right.
The negative plus,
plus de.
Mm-hmm.
See, they've been built with built on different roots apparently, but the actual, you know, to try to find a shade of difference between these two might be real a real challenge. In other words, to look them both up and see if there's any. The idea of and not may be seen more with the ude, see, and with the ute, you may not get that idea of an and. It may be just more of a simple pure neither nor. And maybe with the other is more and neither and nor, that kind of an idea. Maybe is about the only thing I could see on the surface. It would something like this would have to just be analyzed. And they're not giving much distinction here. Okay, good. Yes?
I have another completely different question. Yeah. I was looking at the ARA.
Mm-hmm.
Page 249.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, don't confuse it with the interrogative ara,
mm-hmm.
section 302. And I started comparing them, and particularly because they have ara gay, which is identical to ara gay in
right.
231. And I looked up all these three examples they used for the imperative, and every one can be applied to this law, and I don't see any reason why they separate these three examples. Apparently, these are the only three examples in the New Testament where it's like that.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they pick these three apart? Because they can all be applied very easily in this rule.
Mm-hmm.
And where they get the interrogative is just from the context.
Right.
And even the example they use here on page 249, Mark 4:41, that's used as an interrogative. And then Matthew 12:28. That could be interpreted as an interrogative.
Mm-hmm.
The kingdom of God then come upon you.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they can go back and forth. I see no difference between them.
There isn't any difference. There's no difference in spelling. Again, what you're left to is context. And there is a difference, though, as far as the accent that they put on it. So if you don't have any accents, you can't tell. But see, this ara here has got the acute, and the other one, and the interrogative had a circumflex, but. Of course, how do you know? I mean, if you don't have the accents in the text originally in the unseals.
If the context in the
definition right.
is identical, why did they decide to just put a circumflex on it?
That may be what they did. What they may have done is, well, the word's the same in the unseals, it's sure going to look the same. And that what they may have done is, originally there may have been a pronunciation difference, you know, like or a tone difference, a type of tone difference between circumflex and acute, although we couldn't duplicate it probably. Or they may have done that just like the Masoretes did sometimes to make distinctions between forms, to put different vowel points on things just to make a distinction between forms and to avoid a certain confusion, even though the pronunciation may have been the same and everything else. But that means what they've done is they've made the decision for you.
Yeah.
In other words, they have by their interpretation judged that this is a question, and those things are very, very worthy of challenge. The minuscule manuscripts may have some of those had accent marks. That one might be an older witness. Some of those you might want to check to see what the minuscules did and what the oldest witness to it was, just the way they were looking at it. But that still does not prove the point. And these are judged by context primarily, and then from the context they decide which way they're going to put the mark.
Well, that's what I was pointing out, is that all three examples of these.
Mm-hmm.
The example cited is at the conclusion of a series of statements, and this is meant to be the resulting
right.
conclusion.
Right.
Like Acts 8:30, he just says, "Do you know?" But in Acts 8:30, it says, "And Philip ran through to him and heard him read the prophet Isaiah, and said, understandest thou what thou readest?" I mean,
mm-hmm.
there, you know. Do you understand then what you read?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you understand then what you read? You know, statement.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke 18:8, it's, I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth?
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, shall he then find faith on the earth?
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion of talking about God avenging his own elect. And then...
Yeah, it would still be a question. In that case, it'd still be a question, but the ara would be taken as a then. Yeah, the consequence. Mm-hmm. Well, those are the kinds of things that are debatable. And
Luke 18:8 calls that an adverb.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you're going to get some lots of differences of opinion there.
There's only, as far as he goes, says there's only four uses of arge too.
Mm-hmm.
And all the intestines.
Okay.
So, and every one of them can be a question or.
Yeah. Well, he's made the statement it should not be confused with the interrogative. Now we've just found out that. In other words, we've got it all figured out, and we've already decided what it is. So don't you be worrying about it. You know. So that's the kind of thing I want to try to sensitize you to consider and to question.
There aren't that many uses of it, actually. Mm-hmm. It looks like maybe 30 or 35.
For ara totally?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now that makes it harder to make detailed analysis of it too. But
to be questions too.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that aren't could be so.
Well, we've already seen ambiguity with questions when you didn't have any of these particles, and now when we have some of these in, we still have ambiguities. So I couldn't tell you that there's no ambiguity there. I think there definitely is, especially in view of the fact that the accents aren't a part of the original. If we had the accent, of course, we could rely on that, but that's something to check on the text, too, see if there's variance in the manuscripts on some of the accents on some of these, too. That would be real interesting. Okay. Any other questions on this chapter here? We pretty much got it's covered. Let's take a look at those lessons then. Got 2 minutes to cover the lessons here. For tomorrow, we probably won't get through this today totally. We'll finish this up and then read ahead in lesson 42. That's a shorter one. It's much shorter in length, although it's mostly vocabulary. Then 43, we're going to get into imperative, and then subjunctive. So we'll get back into some verbs or some more grammar. This is just given sentences A and B below, together with their English translations, translate the remaining Greek sentences into English. So the rest of the sentences are going to be built on this kind of thing. So you have hoi grammateis ezetesan ton kurion, the scribe sought the Lord, and hoi pharisoi huron tus mathetas, the Pharisees found the disciple. So we're going to make several combinations of that. So number one, John, why don't you take that one, just read the Greek and then translate.
Hoi grammateis kai hoi pharisaioi ezetesan ton kurion.
Okay.
The scribes and the Pharisees sought the Lord.
Okay, scribes and the Pharisees sought the Lord. So here we're having a compound subject using kai to connect scribes and Pharisees, and that whole unit is functioning as the subject of the sentence. Okay, number two, Jim.
Hoi grammateis ezetesan kai huron tus mathetas. The scribe sought and found the disciples.
And here we have the verb being compound, and two verb forms being joined by chi, functioning together as the compound verb. Okay, and then number three, Eric. Okay. Right. The scribe sought also the disciples. And why here would you translate chi as also rather than and?
Doesn't connect to him.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, if you tried to make a connection between a verb and a noun, and they're not similar things, so you have to do something else with it. Okay, good. Yeah, you could do that, sure. You could say the scribe sought the disciples too. You could do that.
But we need more context to translate it. The scribe